live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. This is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
The plane's last known altitude was 37,000 feet, according to the airline. The plane took off from Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport, carrying 56 passengers and 10 crew.
We will find the airplane. We will find the black boxes.
Major search and rescue operation is underway with teams from Egypt's armed forces and Greece, of course, in order to determine exactly what happened to the plane.
It seems to me that it could be consistent with either a mechanical failure or a terrorist event. Either way, some sort of catastrophic event appears to have occurred.
6:12 in the morning, it's happened again. A modern state-of-the-art jet has disappeared from radar. It's Egypt Air Flight 804. There's a weird observation, but does a crew of 10 with 54 passengers seem like a big number?
No, that's obviously not a full flight.
Three kids on that one, too. No Americans.
Is that right? They've already looked through the manifest?
Yeah, no Americans, 30 Egyptians, 15 French, 2 Iraqis, 1 Briton, 1 Canadian, 1 Belgian, 1 Kuwaiti, 1 Saudi, 1 Algerian, 1 Sudan, Chad, and Portugal.
One of the most telling pieces of information seems to be that they tried to pass off air control from Greek air controllers to Egyptian air controllers while the plane was still on radar and got no response for many minutes. Tom Rivers from ABC News is going to try to fill in some of the gaps here. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
We're doing okay, yeah. The Egyptian and Greek naval and air assets heading to this last known location. And interesting, about the past half hour, the Greek defense minister has come forward and has said, and he must be referring to radar sweeps. He said, it looks like the plane has swerved in the final seconds before contact was lost. So you and I can infer a lot of things into that. But again, we're at the very beginning of this thing, and the Egyptian prime minister had said a couple hours ago, he said, look, don't rule anything in or out at this stage. We have plenty of time to figure this thing out, so don't jump to conclusions.
What is the French government saying since the plane started in Paris?
They're saying right now that Hollande is saying, look, the plane was quote-unquote damaged, and we know it is gone. That's what he's saying at this stage of the game. We know that the French, too, have begun an investigation out at Charles de Gaulle. Anyone in any way, shape, or form had any contact with that flight going to be questioned in the coming hours.
Tom, 37,000 feet is where it disappeared. I heard a stat very early on that of all the planes that have disappeared, gone missing, crashed, less than 10% disappear or lose contact at that altitude. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, the critical part, as you know, is the takeoff and the landing. And once you're up and cruising, you are, by definition, cruising. It's pretty safe. So, yes, by definition, something catastrophic happened, mechanical, technical, or terrorism. At this stage of the game, nothing being ruled out.
The standard operating procedure for a pilot in a handoff of airspace from one air control tower or one air control center to another is acknowledging your switching control. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. And they would have been, you know, close to that line of demarcation between the Greek airspace and the Egyptian. And the Greeks were basically saying, all right, you know, handing over to Egyptian, and got no response. And I guess they had made contact about 10 minutes before, and they came back to them, nothing there.
So it would seem to indicate that that's the crucial time, those minutes. Those are the crucial, that's the time period that the investigators will probably, at least this early on, focus on.
Exactly. And this is just anecdotal evidence, but people on the island of Karpathos say that they saw something like a fireball in the sky last night, middle of the night, their time. And again, they've got some helicopters in that area checking out that immediate area, seeing if, you know, sadly, if they're seeing anything like a debris field at that point in the Eastern Med.
Tom Rivers, ABC News. We'll check in again. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
All right. So that period of time, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, the Greek air controllers are trying to confirm with the pilot of the missing airplane. We're transferring control to Egyptian air control. Mm-hmm. They get no response for several minutes, and now, as Tom Rivers just reported, there was a swerve in the radar tracking the print the plane was making before it disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And then there was that flash before it went down in Greece. Incidentally, the BBC is saying very, very, very slight chance of survivors, but there is still a very small window in which to save them, 2 to 7 hours.
Of course, you got to find debris, and you got to find what's left of the plane if there is anything. So, do we know if it crashed over water?
I think it did crash into the water, into the Eastern Mediterranean.
We'll tell you more when we know more. Again, Ryan, you say no Americans on the flight. The other breakdown nationalities of passengers was what?
Mostly Egyptian and French, a couple of Iraqis, and then British, Canadian, Belgium, Kuwaiti, Saudi, Algerian, Sudan, Chad, and Portugal.
All right, thanks.
I'm not in the yellow pages. But if you got trouble with someone, you might ask around for me, Jackson Healy.
March, Jack Healy. I'm not here to hurt you, so I'm gonna ask you a question.
No. How stupid do you think I am? I got a license to carry, and ever since your little visit, this little baby's gonna stay right here.
Yeah. This movie may suck, but the soundtrack's already good. The music of my people. Nick DiGelio joins us now at Nick D Show on social media. Good morning, man.
Morning.
This is a Fly Jam soundtrack.
It is absolutely a Fly Jam soundtrack. The movie takes place in 1977, when Fly Jams were everywhere.
And you had screaming disc jockeys on every radio station.
That's right. That's right. The good old days.
There was never anyone here, though, that was that did that. Can you imagine if you had that back? The mighty 720 WGN. You never had that.
I know.
Captain Whammo never worked here, did he?
No, Captain Whammo worked on WMET, man.
All right, so I have heard early reports that I'm going to be disappointed. Am I?
I haven't seen it, but I'm really looking forward to it. And, you know, here's what I've heard. I've heard the you know, the story is not anything new. It's your typical buddy, you know, buddy. Well, they're not cops, private investigator and a guy who beats people up for a living. But they're investigating the disappearance of a young girl. And so, you know, the script has been done before. But what I'm hearing is the chemistry between Crow and Gosling is great. And particularly the raves that I'm hearing are all coming from Gosling. Like, evidently, Gosling is unbelievably funny in this. And, like, he is channeling, if you can believe this, he's channeling, from what I've heard, Lou Costello.
Well, it does kind of make sense, right? You got the slightly paunchy guy and then the skinny guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty funny. I will say this. Ryan Gosling, who I'm often confused for, Ryan Gosling has been great on Saturday Night Live. He's great with Kimmel and with Fallon. You know, so he's great on talk shows when he does shtick.
Yep.
He did a thing with Will Ferrell a couple of weeks ago on...
The Knife Guys?
Yeah, the Knife Guys on Kimmel.
Hilarious.
Which was great. He's got comedy chops.
He does. I mean, you've seen Crazy Stupid Love,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, The Big Short, he was funny in The Big Short.
Big Short, he was funny. No, this guy's funny. And I've often said this, like, great dramatic actors can do comedy. Because comedy's harder, as far as I'm concerned. I've always said this. Comedy is harder than drama, and I believe that. And if you can pull, you know, if you can do comedy, you can pull off drama. And he can kick, you know, I mean, you know, the first time this guy right out of the gate does half Nelson, that's the first time I noticed this guy. And I was like, who is this guy? But he can be very, very, very funny. And yeah, he was great on SNL when he hosted this past season. One of the best episodes of a not very good season, and he was great. So I'm really looking forward to it. You know, and Shane Black wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and that was like a comeback movie for Robert Downey, and the chemistry between him and Val Kilmer was great. And it has that same sort of vibe to it. And it's fun to see a movie that takes place in L.A. and you have a nice reunion with Russell Crowe and Kim Basinger, who made one of the best L.A. movies of all time in L.A. Confidential.
L.A. Confidential was great. By the way, Mike just pointed out that we haven't said the name of the movie yet. Nice Guys. Nice Guys.
Oh, it's The Nice Guys. Yeah,
yeah, the Nice Guys. Guys.
Yeah.
And it's out Friday. What about Neighbors 2?
Oh, God. I will be seeing it tonight. I'm going to see it tonight before my show.
I really, really like Rose Byrne. I think she's great in just about everything she does.
Yeah.
I really, really think Seth Rogen is the most overrated actor in America.
Well, my glass ceiling for Seth Rogen busted about 3 years ago. You know, I mean, I thought, you know, when he first burst onto the scene, I liked him on Freaks and Geeks. I thought he was very funny in 40-Year-Old Virgin. I thought he was funny and Knocked Up. And then it started to grow tiresome. I hated the first Neighbors. I hated it.
Right.
I mean, it should have been called Horrible Parents is what that movie should have been called.
Right.
But now, you know, now they're bringing Chloe Moretz into it. I mean, like a really beautiful and talented, incredible young actress. And the stuff that they're making her do, at least in the trailers, is embarrassing. And so I didn't, you know, I didn't even know that this movie would require a sequel. I you know, I couldn't believe it. When I saw the trailer for it a few months ago, I was like, seriously, they're going to make another one of these? But Seth Rogen has been just the Seth Rogen and, you know, those Apatow guys, my patience for them is pretty much done. It really is.
Well, it's the rewriting of comedy. Everything's got to have, you know, a fart joke. Everything's got to have a joke where somebody falls in an outdoor toilet. Everything's got to, you know, there's got to be something that's over the line that appeals to the 12-year-old in you. And
you know,
it takes a lot to, you know, it's not even offend. It takes a lot for me to go, well, that's just stupid, and it's not even remotely funny. That, and so much of Judd Apatow's stuff gets there for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very funny how history repeats itself, Steve, because in the late 70s, we got some really terrific movies that were vulgar, they were R-rated, and the R-rated comedy really took off. And I'm talking about movies like Slapshot, movies like Animal House.
Yeah.
And in the early 80s, you had Caddyshack, you had Stripes. These were all R-rated comedies. But then, just like what's happening now, it just goes too far. And like in the early 80s, it was Porky's, it was Hard Bodies, it was all the... And the
people forget, wasn't Meatballs rated R initially?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's interesting.
Stripes?
Because the same, Stripes was rated R, Caddyshack was R, you know, Blues Brothers was rated R, and so a lot of the R-rated comedies from that era were good, but then they just thought, all right, now we know how to package these movies. Put some boobs in it, have somebody say the F word, someone can fart and drop their pants, and it'll be the same kind of thing. And that's, you know, why there have been four Porky's movies. And the same exact thing is happening now. It's just history repeating itself.
You could go through any Judd Apatow movie, and he misses a lot, but you could go through any Judd Apatow movie and you can go, I'll take this 15 minutes out, and it's the 15 minutes you don't need, which is the gutter stuff, and it's a better movie.
Well, and he, you know, Apatow is one of these guys who needs an editor. I mean, my God, all of his movies are over 2 hours.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yep.
And you know, I don't know. But, it's, you know, a lot of the guys that came from those movies, like, I really like Paul Rudd. I think Paul Rudd
is
great. And I love Steve Carell. All these guys that came out of there, they're all talented. But it's the Seth Rogen guys that were in, like, This is the End, which is an unwatchable movie.
Right.
And I don't know what kind of blackmail photos Danny McBride has of people.
Right.
But how this guy continues to get cast, I don't understand. I've never laughed once at anything Danny McBride has ever said. I just don't get it.
You're on the radio. You're on the radio tonight, right?
Yeah, 2 a.m. I'll be on. It's Fly James Friday.
That's what I was setting you up for, because really all we care is that Nice Guys is watchable. I'll even take watchable because the soundtrack's so good, I don't even need a great movie. I'd like it, but I want it to be watchable and fun. So get me there, will you?
I will. And we'll review that one on Monday morning, on the Monday morning movie reviews. And I do want to mention really quickly, the Chicago Critics Film Festival kicks off Friday, programmed by local Chicago film critics. A lot of directors, actors, and stars are coming in. It's May 20th through the 26th at the Music Box Theater. Tickets are available now. There's exclusive premieres throughout the entire week, special guests. It's our association worked really, really hard putting this thing together, led by Eric Childress, who's, you know, regular on my show every Monday morning. And he led this thing, programming it and flying in celebrities and directors and writers and stuff. It's the 4th annual Chicago Critics Film Festival. Tickets are on sale now. It's at the Music Box Theater. Starts Friday, goes through Thursday.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
After many, many months of objection by the Speaker to discuss any type of reform, the Speaker has indicated he will open negotiations on collective bargaining, local governments, pension reform, and also workmen's compensation reform. Those are the key to breaking the impasse.
It was a good meeting because, again, the governor indicated he's supportive of revenue to balance the budget, and we're going to have working groups on his reform.
That's the Republican leader Durkin and the Senate President Cullerton. It's funny, right? Because, yeah, they came our way. And then the other guy goes, yeah, they came our way. Pat Brady will join us in just a second to talk about that. Let me go to Andrea and Ryan on the Egypt Air flight here. What's the latest, Andrea, you saw from the Greek government?
It's so bizarre. Ryan and I are keeping in contact with this back and forth. This, according to ABC News, the Greek Ministry of Defense telling ABC that the Egypt Air pilot, this just gets more bizarre.
By the way, if you just got up, this is Egypt Air Flight 804, disappeared off radar last night. 56
passengers, 10 crew.
Yeah, 66 total.
All right, so what are the Greeks saying?
All right, apparently Egypt Air, the pilot, they lost contact at about 27,000 feet, which is bizarre, 37,000 rather, which is bizarre in itself because that's not an altitude at which you would normally lose contact. The pilot of this plane, according to the Greek Ministry of Defense, made a 90-degree turn to the left and then a 360-degree maneuver, so essentially flipping the entire plane into a circle. This is, he was losing about 20,000 feet in altitude. That's when contact with the plane was lost. So it made a sharp turn left, then a 360, and then dropped 20,000 feet.
And it's important to note, we don't know who was in control at that point, too. We don't know that for sure. If it was indeed the pilot who was there, or maybe someone else at the controls, we're not sure.
Pat Brady, you're a pilot, and if we're going to engage in speculation, I'd rather engage in speculation with a pilot than have me shoot my mouth off, even though, you know, I'm special at that. If a plane is flying fine, and suddenly there's that sort of move, could it be a mechanical that he's trying to deal with?
Not likely. I mean, that's
so
the
it feels more like a struggle in the cockpit or somebody else takes control of the plane.
Or yeah, I mean, that's the safest. When you're at 37,000 feet, and I'm not a commercial pilot, but that's the safest part of your flights when you're up there, everything's smooth. And so if something like that goes wrong, there have been examples like the Air France plane that crashed in the ocean a couple years ago where they had some instrument malfunctions, and the pilots actually stalled the plane and it fell out of the sky. I mean, that can happen, but this sounds really unusual.
And wouldn't you, and Ryan chime in this on as well, if you had the people flying the plane that were supposed to fly the plane and you were falling, couldn't somebody issue a mayday at that point and at least respond to the call from the tower?
I mean, you know, that's the thing that they're sifting through right now, because they didn't get a distress call. They got some kind of distress signal. We're hoping that this new press conference that's coming up here in a matter of moments gives us a little more insight into that, what that distress signal was.
And then we have to find out, too, if there was a report of seeing a flash from the ground in the air, somebody on the ground.
Multiple reports or just an individual?
Two reports said that there was some sort of flash in the air. So you want to know if it exploded in the air, there was some sort of, you know, fire or whatnot that people could see from the ground, or if it just went down, boom, crashed into the ocean.
Well, remember when the TWA flight that was over Long Island that went down, there were all kinds of reports of rocket launches towards the plane that turned out not to be true. I mean, it is so early, but it is very rare and unusual at 37,000 feet that something bad happens.
And we're way, 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 way early to start talking about this. However, if that plane left Paris, one of the, for obvious reasons, safest airports in the world, and there was an active terrorist event on a plane that was presumed to leave Paris safely, that changes things. That's a problem.
Well, even the debate you guys were having yesterday, we were all talking about the TSA lines and what a pain that is, but It's a dangerous world in international travel now. So maybe, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but it sure scares me.
You guys think it's a coincidence? France's lower house of parliament has just approved a 2-month extension of the state of emergency.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. I mean, this is still dating back to those November 13th attacks, but they said, you know what, let's keep this going for a couple more months.
By the way, here's another, anybody flying out of O'Hare and Midway today, both O'Hare and Midway tweeting again, get there at least 2 to 2.5 hours because they're expecting long security lines again today.
Saw the picture from Stephanie Menendez. Did you guys see that this morning?
No.
It looked fun. Oh, boy.
She's got her two little kids with her.
Oh, yeah.
She got on those.
But again, I think there's two separate discussions going on here. We have the ability to deal with the TSA problem in a manner that's a little bit more efficient than 2.5 hours.
That's ridiculous.
Finding terrorists is a little bit more of a challenge. And frankly, dealing with the TSA problem in a more efficient manner is going to give us a better chance at keeping bad guys off airplanes.
It'd be nice to get some leadership on this, have a big summit, maybe led by the United States, saying enough's enough. Because, I mean, what a cowardly way to kill a bunch of civilians.
Right.
Just absolute cowards.
Yeah. Well, they're all cowards.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you something right now. I hope hell is really hot. And I don't mean a dry heat, because wherever bin Laden is, and I think he's got the small room with no bathroom, I hope it's really, really, really terrible, because all of this stems from bin Laden. All of it.
It does.
Everything that bad that's happened, all of it, the Middle East, all of it, maybe it would have happened eventually. But the timing of all of this was expedited by the existence of that maniac and the fact that somebody didn't take him out a long time before 2011.
But think of the families and think of the people on that plane and just the absolute terror and agony they went through because these cowards decided to blow up a civilian airliner.
No, that's absolutely
right. Terrible.
And keep in mind, the majority of these lunatics are killing Muslims, not Americans, not Westerners. They're killing Muslims. So it is the crazies of the Islamic population. It is not the Muslim people. So, and it's always important to say that after something like this happens, because what's the immediate assumption we all jump to? Somebody, some radical fundamentalist Islamic Muslim terrorist blew up an airplane. And obviously we don't know any of that. It's 6:48. Well, you heard from Durkin. You heard from Cullerton. Pat Brady has been sentenced to Springfield many times. We'll find out if he has any insight on what's happening in Springfield, if there really is light at the end of the tunnel, or if that's the train and it's coming our way.
I'm supportive of a grand compromise. The critical thing to me is that we have reforms so we can grow our economy and help these businesses. Many members, the rank and file members in the General Assembly, have indicated they're willing to do a grand compromise, and we're hopeful that the leaders will be open to that as well. I've said repeatedly, I'm open. I think if you hear the statements on the other side, you don't hear openness.
Pat Brady's here. Next Generation Strategies. Pat_Brady on social media. How are you, my friend?
Good. Can I plug something else?
Yeah.
Congratulations to Ben Canute from Geneva, Illinois, Marmion High School Academy grad, University of Arizona Wildcat. Made the Olympic triathlon team last weekend.
Hey, how great is that?
That is really great. Had a Facebook picture today of him with his uniform on, and congratulations.
You know the kid?
Oh, yeah. I watched him grow up. His parents, Mike and Eileen Canute, great people, but he's going to the Olympics.
How great is that? Congratulations, Ben. All right, so you just heard Governor Rauner. Prior to that, we played Durkin and Cullerton. Durkin said, hey, the Democrats are coming our way. Cullerton said, hey, the Republicans are coming our way. It is a fact that Governor Rauner was on this show 3 and 4 months ago saying, I'm willing to give up this, 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 and this, and Madigan did nothing. Now it appears there's a crack. Am I overreading it?
Maybe the speaker blinked, and maybe he's going to agree to some of the reforms that the governor's wanted, but you're correct. The governor ran on 44, 45 different things he wanted to get done. He's down to 4 or 5, which the speaker terms as radical, things like term limits and redistricting reform and work comp reform, things that have been on the table for a long time, given local control.
And by the way, there's nothing radical about redistricting and term limits.
Oh, no, I'm joking.
I'm making the point.
Yeah. The speaker said, yeah, maybe we might be open to that. But the reality is President Cullerton's been working hard. The rank and file been working hard. Leader Durkin, Leader Redonio, everybody's working to get a deal. And the word in Springfield is only person that doesn't want a deal is a speaker.
So at this point, is Madigan in a position where he feels he has to make a deal? Because everything we know about Madigan is he's not going to do it until he has to do it.
Well, there's two things that can happen. We can get a deal here with some reforms, and we can move on and actually start working on the other things we need in this state, like a capital bill and fixing some of the infrastructure. Or he can just blow it up. Now, there's some people down there that think at the end, the last hour, that he's going to blow the whole thing up and we won't have a budget. But that helps him. The chaos is good for him politically, so he tends to do what's good for him politically. And this was a theme in the campaign. I do truly believe this. Governor Rauner's thinking of the next generation, and I think the speaker's thinking of the next election.
So going forward, what are the chances that another budget that's not able to be balanced would be presented, and therefore the reports on it would be the governor's got a budget? He's just not doing anything with it because people won't go deep enough to understand he can't deal with a budget that's out of whack. In other words, will Madigan set him up for a bad political headline?
Well, I think what might happen is if the speaker will submit a budget that's out of balance by $4 or $5 billion, even though the Constitution requires a balanced budget, and he's going to tell the governor, then you make the cuts. Now, the governor said in his State of the State, you give me that power and I will. So I think this time around the governor probably will make the cuts. And I have to give the governor credit. He's put tax increases on the table, which for a Republican is a tough thing for a lot of people to swallow. And he put cuts on the table. The only person that hasn't put anything on the table is the Speaker of the House.
So you're in Springfield all the time. Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or something in the middle?
I'm something in the middle, more optimistic. And listen, give the rank and file members of the legislature, both the Democrats and the Republicans, a ton of credit for working very, very hard to try to get a budget done. You can't put this mess on them. They are really trying to get something done. It's just up to the big guy to see if he wants to play ball. Or if
big guy meaning the little guy?
Yeah, the speaker, if he wants to play ball or if he wants to continue the chaos. And I was down there yesterday watching the rally, and I see the public sector, government sector union people there, and then I see the trades, and I wish the trades weren't there because, you know, and what Governor Rauner's talking about, a pro-growth agenda, we want jobs for people, and we want people to live and work and be able to stay in Illinois, and in the direction we're going, it's just not working.
Pat, just to be clear, all the services that were halted or pay that was not received, that will there be any sort of back pay, or does that just resume and pick up and you can, if you lost.
What the controller, Leslie Munger, did is she just put the legislature to the back of the line like every other vendor.
Okay.
So they'll get paid. It's just they're going to get paid like everybody else.
And the services that were cut or some of the benefits that caregivers and the like are special needs services that were not being paid, will they get that as back pay, or they'll get it?
Does everybody get whole?
I assume if they're owed, they get whole. But remember, 90% of the budget's operating on autopilot by consent decree or law. And we're the social services you're talking about, I am assuming that they're all going to be made whole. I hope they are going to be made whole. But I think we're at a $9 or $10 billion debt right now, not deficits year over year. Debt is just money we owe. That doesn't include the pensions. So the reality is, we probably will get a tax increase, but we need some cut. But more importantly, we need more taxpayers, not necessarily more taxes, and that's what the pro-growth agenda is about.
Because you're trying to get and keep people in state. It's a couple minutes before and get the people in state to be able to run a business where they can pay more.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio.
WGN Chicago.
720 WGN.
712. Pat Brady's here. Eric Edelstein will join us shortly, as will Rick Pearson. And, I'll tell you more about a guest coming up later in the hour, which is, just another American hero we're trotting up for you. At Tom Dart on social media, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart joins us now. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to have you back on. And I've turned Pat Brady's microphone on here so he can jump in as well. And Andrea's here.
Yeah.
Let me just give you
the heavy hitters there with Pat, yeah. Andrea, and Rick Pearson coming.
That's exactly right. We have a swinging light bulb over your head, too, where we got you in the back. We're going to tune you up.
I'm worried about with this lineup.
Let me just throw a couple of things at you, starting with, when are you announcing your run for mayor, and will you do it on this show?
Yeah. I am it's funny, Steve. I find myself questioning myself at times, but I really, really still enjoy my job. I really do. And it works for my family. So I told people I'd look at the mayor's race as something down the road that I won't dismiss as outright and just say I won't look at it. But as far as what I'm going to do with my future, I really, in the most sincere way, I have such a full agenda right now going to the sheriff's office. I can't emphasize enough to you, running for mayor couldn't be further from my mind. I just got my hands full and really liking it too, which just defies reason and logic at times.
Well, and it is 3 years away, so it's not like you have to do it today, but just call us when you're ready.
You'll be the first to know.
There are several things on your agenda, specifically in the job as Cook County Sheriff, that are all relevant and all important. What's a rocket ducket?
You know, that was something that we came up with when I was trying to think of ways that I could help expedite people who are sitting in jail that we clearly don't need to have sitting in jail. And Steve, it's one of those things, the more I invest in my thinking, what little time I have in my life to thinking about the whole criminal justice system, you really find out that if we're really going to solve the problems of, like, the violence on the street and all the shootings and the rest of it, we clearly have to make sure that what resources we have in the criminal justice system are being used for those violent people, and not just through neglect, we're just sweeping up hapless people, mentally ill people, you name it, and keeping them, because they eat up money, and frankly, they usually eat up more money than a person who's in there on a violent crime. So for us, like Rocket Doc, it says that if you're in on these inconsequential crimes like retail theft, possession of small amounts of drugs, suspended driver's license, that you're not going to sit in a jail for more than 30 days unless you have some violence in your background. And you'd be stunned how many people fit in that category. And they say the big picture here, Steve, is if you do that, we now have more resources to deal with this violence on the streets. But people, I found, just don't look at it that way. It is, you know, it's the system, what can you do type of thing. But there's a finite amount of money out there, and if we're wasting it on people that shouldn't be in the criminal justice system because they're mentally ill and the criminal justice system wasn't meant for them in the first place, or for people on inconsequential crimes, we won't have any money left to deal with the violence. So the Rocket Doc and a couple of other things we're doing is just focus at getting, making sure we have the right people in the jail and the other folks getting them out of there as quick as we can.
Hey, Tom's Pet, and we've been friends now for 30 years, and I say this unapologetically, you're one of the finest public servants I've ever seen. And,
you were Pet, or you're Tom, I mean.
Thomas. And, okay. And that endorsement, and I can at least bring one of my two friends with it. That should carry the day in the mayor's race if you get in. But, hey, talk about the Safer Foundation. We went to that dinner the other night where they, and particularly the guy that had been in jail 50 times and now is a PhD.
Yeah, you know, Pat, that was amazing that night. Honestly, those folks are incredible. They have done this for years now, and I'd say with probably little fanfare, at least not what they deserve. Here is people who get it. And when I say get it, it's not, honestly, Steve, Pat, it's not like, you know, I've cornered the market and everything that works in the criminal justice system, you know, probably quite the contrary. But let's use common sense. 85% of the people that come into Cook County Jail are not going to prison. They're going right back to the street, right back to the communities. And if we aren't giving them some type of, you know, hope out there, you know, with some job skills or something like that, what do you think is going to happen? They're probably going to be coming right back in. The numbers all say that. The Safer Foundation has been focusing their entire efforts forever on giving people job skills when they leave. And I'd say, you know, that's compassionate, that's thoughtful. I really feel that way. But fiscally speaking, it is the smartest thing in the world. And as Pat mentioned, this one guy, my God, the guy just went out and got his PhD after spending time in and out of jail, prison, whatever it was, for, you know, nonviolent-related offenses. But I think the public is finally coming to the understanding that, you know, most of these people who have been swept into the criminal justice system are not there because of violence. They're there because of drugs, because of minor crimes. And whether you want to care about them or not, that's not the point. The point is that just constantly bringing them back in the criminal justice system is so expensive, we're running out of money. And so people like the Safer Foundation, Pat, put these really cool programs together, linking people with jobs, real jobs, not like theoretical ones, real jobs. They're sustained. They stay with these people. So there are solutions out there so that, once again, we can connect people with jobs that will create a livelihood for them where they're not involved in criminal justice. And then we can just focus on these violent people who, you know, Steve, we could spend the rest of the day trying to figure out how these people got so violent and why it is that way. But the bottom line is they need to be kept away from the rest of the population. And we can't do that if we're wasting all of our money on people that shouldn't be in there.
Yeah, by the way, it's saferfoundation.org if you can support it, which is great. Several more things to hit you with. Give me 30 seconds to get a traffic update at 7:18. Here's Mary.
Inbound Eisenhower, an hour 15 from 53, hour 5 from Mannheim up to 55. Outbound as well to 53. Inbound Stevenson, hour 15 from the Tri-States. A big sunshine delays this morning. Inbound Ryan's up to 25 from 95th. The Kennedy, 46 in from O'Hare, 55. Outbound, 26 on the Edens in both directions. Northbound, 355. Watch for an accident. The exit to 88. It's jammed up now from 127th to about 63rd. Lakeshore Drive busy into Belbo. Mary Vandeveld, WTN Traffic Central.
Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, at Tom Dart on social media. One of the things we were just talking about relates directly to legislation on expungement of records. And we actually charge people to get their record expunged, which I feel is an exorbitant fee. You know, it's more than a paperwork fee. But there's a third and fourth and fifth and sixth steps that everybody has to go through. Are these fair steps, or do we need legislation to clean this process up?
Oh, but see, we need to clean this up. This Pat could, you know, say, you know, Pat and I, you know, can try triple homicide cases. Pat can try outrageously complicated financial crime cases. But good luck trying to figure out the expungement world. I mean, you literally have to be a specialist in it because it's so nuanced. Forget about it if you're trying to do it yourself. And what, once again, what are we accomplishing here, you know, by trying to make it so difficult for someone to clean up a nonviolent record of something you did 10, 15 years ago? And so we have some bills in Springfield that don't begin, Steve, to get at it completely. We're just trying to nibble around the edges here. But just nibbling around the edges, I'm getting the most absurd pushback from people. And one of them, we're trying to do two things. One, saying that if you committed a offense 20 years ago, whatever it is, say you can't expunge it, but you do something, you know, 2 years ago, like, a retail theft, and it got thrown out, that the fact you had a previous conviction doesn't mean you can't get the other ones off your record.
Right
now it says if you have any conviction ever, you can't get anything off your record, which is just dumb. And then the other one says, if, heaven forbid, if you're innocent or your case was dropped, we aren't going to charge you to have your record cleaned up here for that offense. And I found that one the most outrageous because I'm getting pushback from the state police on it saying that that's money and they can't afford to have the revenue loss. And I keep saying to them, folks, you're not listening to me. These are people that were found not guilty. They're innocent. We can't charge them $120 to clean up a record for something they didn't do. And as Pat and I know, there's a myriad of reasons why people have cases dropped and things like that. I get it. But at the end of the day, the majority of these people were found not to be culpable for what they were charged with, and we're going to charge them $120, and then we're going to act surprised when they can't get a job because someone looked at their record and saw an arrest on there that got thrown out. And it's like, guys, what are we doing here?
Well, it's essentially it's legislated blackmail. It's like, okay, you're innocent? Okay, give me $120, and I'll give you paperwork that says you're innocent.
Steve, you nailed it. That's exactly what it is. This isn't even into that discussion philosophically where you and I can sit there and say, well, a property crime should be expunged or not expunged. This is saying, no, just you didn't do it.
Right.
It's black. You're 100% right, Steve.
Sheriff, I wanted to ask you, too, about Baroque, the scandal. Obviously, it was 7 years ago, but this week there was a little bit of closure. I know you were a pallbearer at the reinternment, basically the funeral for, what, some 2,000 bones that had been stored as evidence for the trials. Is that, in fact, closure to the scandal, or is that case still open?
You know, it's closure, and unfortunately, the only way we can do it, the best way. I swear to you, when I first came out there, we knew it was bad, but we had no idea the enormity of it. I mean, we found hundreds of graves that had been desecrated, and we frankly assumed we know it was much more. But so we knew of at least 200. But when I first got out there, I didn't realize how big it was. And I was thinking, okay, well, we'll find remains in different locations, and then we'll match them. We'll allow family members to give DNA, and then we'll match them and things like that. No, the way that these folks did this thing, these criminals, is they scattered the remains everywhere. They smashed them. They then destroyed record after record where we couldn't even tell where people were originally supposed to be buried. So even if we had a grave that clearly had been tampered with, we didn't know who was supposed to be in there because all the records were gone. So for us, it was sort of a hollow closure because there was no family we were able to say, because of our work, we now have the remains back where they were supposed to be. All we could say is that we now have a peaceful place where all of the remains that we recovered are at one location. If you have any concerns, it's a peaceful place with a beautiful marker. You can go out there and pray there. And other than that, we weren't able to help people like you really wish to, especially in the day and age we're now with DNA and NCIS. You think this would be easy, but if you'd seen what I saw out there, you'd understand there was no way to connect anything to anything.
I appreciate your time, at Tom Dart. And by the way, there's a rape kit legislation good news as well, because that piece that you pushed forward before is going to prevent the same sort of nightmare scenario where a bunch of rape kits weren't processed and robins won't be happening again. So listen, this job that you love, obviously you need some sort of checkup. This job that you love has no endless to-do list, but we appreciate your time, and thanks for coming on.
Steve, thank you so much for having me on. Pat, you too, Andrew. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank right, you,
enjoy
Sheriff.
Enjoy the day. At Tom Dart.
I thought he was going to announce.
Well, he will. He'll call back. I got a note from a listener last night, and a 31-year police veteran who is not a Tom Dart fan. And, you know, a good, hardworking cop. And I know guys like Tom Dart who come from the non-walk-a-beat world deal with pushback from the rank-and-file guys all the time. I would never presume to understand both sides of the argument. All I would say in defense of the sheriff is he's fighting political battles that have nothing to do with how you handle yourself on the street. And I think you both, try to understand each other as much as you can, and you're going to get along better. And I'm not knocking the guy that sent me the note. He's entitled to his opinion, obviously. It's just what I know of Tom Dart. He's doing the best he can in a very difficult situation.
Just an observation. Again, just an observation. I think Tom Dart has made more movement in that office, in that position, than a lot of people in other similar positions, let's just say.
And to go back to the beginning of his discussion about the other things we were talking about, isn't it amazing how much people fight common sense? All right, let's jump to Rick Pearson here. And Rick is with your Chicago Tribune, chicagotribune.com, and also Channel 9 CL TV. And, of course, most importantly to me, the Morning Spin. Every Sunday morning at 7, you got a plug for the weekend?
Yes, I do. I've got State Senator Andy Menar. I had him on recently. He's the one who's kind of one of the driving forces for trying to change the state school aid formula. It's a very hot topic in Springfield and about the fate of whether schools will open in the fall. There'll be state funding. And so I thought it was important to have him back on the show.
We're going to get into the Hillary Clinton troubles here shortly, but she's in town to raise money?
Yes, indeed. Two stops, a fundraiser in Park Ridge and also a fundraiser in the city. She's been having a lot of big money fundraisers across the country. Trying to gear up money for the general election and to take on Donald Trump.
I don't know if you know, she's from Park Ridge and New York and Park Ridge.
And Park Ridge and Chicago. She was born in Chicago and raised in Park Ridge.
We were talking about Springfield earlier. What do you have on whether or not there's light on the end of the tunnel?
I always tend to play the pessimist.
What?
I know. Yeah, believe it or not. Sure, there's a lot of talk going on, and the governor talking about optimism for a grand bargain happening. But the stakes are very big, and they're very big politically. And I'm going to stay pessimistic. I'm not sure that there's any chance of coming up with a comprehensive deal.
And outside of the push from Cullerton and Durkin, as stated, is there a rank and file push on Madigan? I didn't expect the Madigan to move.
Well, there's discontent on rank and file on both sides. And, that helped lead to some of these backroom discussions, these so-called working groups. But still, the bottom line doesn't change. There won't be a fix to the budget unless the governor is able to get some of those items on his turnaround agenda. There's certainly places that Madigan can move on things. Things like workers' compensation changes, things like property tax freeze, those kinds of things. But, yesterday you had 10,000 union members marching in Springfield, Madigan on the stage pumping his fist like a rock star. That's not going to make things move very quickly.
No, and he's accused the governor of sending the wrong message many times. That didn't help. In the meantime, you are on Sunday morning at 7 a.m., and I don't know if you know this, Rick. The highly rated Sunday Spin.
I'm very happy to hear that.
Yes, and it's a terrific show, and you can get all the political talk you need on TV Sunday mornings after you get the stuff from Rick to start your day, because he sets you up with what's happening in the city and in the state and nationally as well. It's you do a great job with that show.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it very much.
At Rap30 on social media.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
Many of the pundits and politicians, they say Bernie Sanders should drop out. The people of California should not have the right to determine who the next president will be. Well, let me be as clear as I can be. I agree with you. We are in to the last ballot is cast.
That's Ultimate Fighter Bernie Sanders. His cage match schedule is not available at this time, but if you check his website, you'd probably get that. And, of course, try to wipe the image of him in a Ultimate Fighter leotard out of your head. Eric Adelson's here. Eric, you guys got a problem.
Which one?
The Democratic Party has an issue here, and the issue is Bernie is, and for those of you under the age of 30, I'll explain the reference later, Glenn Close from Fatal Attraction. He's about to sit up in the tub. You just can't kill him.
Are there dead rabbits on the stove?
He did boil a bunny. I'm just not sure who it belonged to. So what is happening here?
Well, look, when you start as a protest candidate, which he did, you protest all the way to the end. I do think it'll change after California, which is...
Well, that's the last one. It's got to.
Well, no, but I understand. But this idea that this fight will go on and on and on, I think on June 5th, his words were chosen carefully. He said, till the last ballot is cast. Now, obviously, he could take this to the convention. I think he believes in his mind he's going to profoundly change the Democratic Party, have an impact on the platform, really affect things going forward. But, you know, a former member of Congress who served with him a long time had a comment who said, "This the Bernie you're seeing now is why he never got along with anybody in Congress, because he just sort of plays by his own rules and doesn't really care about anybody else. And, you know, look how high the stakes are in this election. I don't think what he's doing right now will have long-term harm, but it is an annoyance.
Yeah, and there's a poll that's out this morning that says Hillary is now behind Trump. Well, Bernie can still beat Trump head-to-head, and Hillary cannot. This is not helping.
No, it's not. You got to look underneath, particularly these public polls. Pat and I have talked about this a long time. I think what you're seeing is Trump is, because of the capitulation of the Republican Party, Pat Brady notwithstanding, is consolidating Republicans. His numbers are still horrendous among independents, horrendous among women, terrible among minorities. But what you're seeing is that classic sort of post-nomination consolidation of Republicans. It's a serious thing. I think the Republican Party is now complicit in it. But, you know, I think some of this natural tightening would happen anyway.
Campaigns are all about getting people to feel good about something enough, whether or not I can pull it off so they can actually come and vote for
me. Not this one.
That's what I was just going to say. No. This campaign has been about fear and getting people angry.
Well, you're going to have, and again, putting aside your partisan inclinations, you're going to have probably the two most unpopular party nominees running at the same time in American history. And combine that with Citizens United, combine that with social media, combine that with the amount of money that will be spent. This is going to be an unbelievable race to the bottom.
Why, though, is Bernie Sanders still in this? Does he think? Is he think? He
What's
mathematically,
the end
game? Yeah, he mathematically can't catch up to her. And I know he's not. He's an intelligent man. He knows that.
Right.
So what is the end
game?
Well,
he spent his career kind of spitting in the wind, trying to get attention on these issues.
Is his moment.
This is his moment. And why step away from the stage when the Klieg lights are on you? So. You know,
it does come down to that.
It's hard to walk away.
Yeah. Yeah. Will he have some role in a Hillary Clinton White House if she were to win?
Hard for me to see that. I mean, again, he's a lone wolf who's never really played well in the sandbox. But look, the days of predicting this election and what happens during it or after are long gone, particularly for me.
Is there a way that she could try to embrace his supporters more wholly, or are they checked out on her?
Look, I think there's a fundamental dynamic in campaigns. The election comes down to a choice. And when it's abstract and theoretical, like, oh, it could be Bernie, it could be her, it could be Trump, it could be someone else, it becomes very concrete when these are the two people on the ballot. Who do you want? You know, the classic lesser
of two evils.
Which
is why the polls don't matter right now.
Well, number one, the national polls don't matter, because it's a state-by-state election, as we know. And number two, once there's a choice, I think things become much more crystallized.
Is there anything that she could change that would make her anything less than, my words, not yours, a really terrible candidate?
Well, look, Steve, you had her on this show, and she was
a human being.
She was natural. She was funny. She was talking about her grandkids. She was giving you advice on your grandkids. You know, and I think, again, we've talked about this before, it's sort of after that 30 years of being subject to attack, and some of it self-induced, but a lot of it not, you're sort of in that protective mode, and it's hard for her to break out of that.
Here's something Trump does better than she does. He doesn't blame the Democrats by name for everything. And if I were on Hillary Clinton's team, the first thing I would say to her is, the next time the phrase, "the Republicans did this to me," comes out of your mouth, you need to go home and wash your mouth out with soap, because there's a lot of people who have no interest in voting for Donald Trump, who consider themselves Republicans, who don't want to be grouped in, because you're going to think that she is an extension of the left, and she won't see anything favorable for anybody on the right in any way, shape, or form. Why would a moderate Republican vote for her?
Well,
other than the fact that the other choice is Trump.
Right.
And that's what you know, and along those lines, remember in the very early, I think one of the first debates, where she defined her enemies as Republicans. Remember that? That's going to come back.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
President of the United States, not President of the Democrats.
There's a lot that'll come back. But here's what I would say, though. And you know, she is somebody who is a fighter and a scrapper. And she does best, I think, when she's a bit of an underdog. I think she did better when she, you know, was down after losing New Hampshire. And I think to have somebody who's as gritty and has fought these battles for as long as she has, that's kind of the street fighter you want against Donald Trump. I hate to say it, but I think there's something to be said for that. And I think we'll see how it plays out this fall.
I want to invite you guys to stick around for a second, and we're going to get off politics because we have the honor of talking to Clinton Romachet, Medal of Honor recipient, in just a second. His life story's out, and if you guys want to chime in on this, you're certainly welcome to do it. I hope you will. The book's called Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. You don't get the Medal of Honor for phoning it in, kids. And the story of what Romachet went through, and as he would tell you, what his guys went through, is unbelievable. 7:52, studio full of very talented folks here. All of us excited to have the opportunity to say hi to Staff Sergeant Clinton Romachet, a true American hero and a Medal of Honor recipient. His book, Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor, is out and available now. Sergeant, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thank you for your service. The story is unbelievable. And just to give folks a little bit of background, I think most people will remember the name Combat Outpost Keating. October 3rd, 2009, about 3 days before the dismantling of the COP was scheduled to begin and be finished in short order, 300 Taliban fighters overrun the perimeter, and a 13-hour battle takes place where you led a small group of your friends and comrades in a battle that took out 150 of those Taliban. I guess the most important question I would ask you is, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Like I said, another day to try and improve ourselves or those around us. So that's where we like to focus on.
And did you, when you came home, because we focus a lot in this country about how we take care of soldiers who come back because of the extraordinary circumstances you focused on that day, so much was made of your heroic actions, and you were ferried from one ceremony to the other. Have you had time to be able to process what goes on between your ears and in your heart to keep yourself okay?
You know, for me, it was an understanding that every time I went overseas, I knew I was going to be faced with things that, you know, I'll never will forget, but to understand that when it comes time to coming back home, those things can stay in the countries they happened in. And as time has gone on now, part of my healing process has been able to, like I said, to write the book Red Platoon and to immortalize those eight men that can no longer tell their story, share their story, and hopefully the American people will see and understand that service and sacrifice that goes throughout this great country for the men and women that put on the military uniform. That's been my therapy, and that's what helps motivate me to move forward.
Clint, thank you for your service, first of all, because, I mean, without you, we wouldn't be here. So thank you for your service. My question is, do you keep in touch with a lot of people from back home now, or is it kind of when you get back home, you get back into your lives, your previous lives?
I definitely keep in touch with a lot of people I either grew up with or served with. In fact, I was just down in Nebraska this Sunday with Sergeant Larson. We were branding about 60 head of cows. He needed some help, so I drove 8 hours south to go hook up with him and help him out there on his little ranch in Nebraska. And that's kind of the connection you always make, that if any of your buddies need help for no matter what reason, you're always going to be there for them.
I guess you'd never pull Medal of Honor rank and go, hey, I don't have to do that. You're the guy.
No, you know, it's still the same guy before it as I was receiving it afterwards. And, you know, having great friends and family and support to understand that, you know, they'll always be there no matter what. It's truly important to keep pushing forward.
Thank you. This is Pat. The question I had, because I'm familiar with the story, and as a soldier, how do you manage the fear when you're in that circumstance? I mean, it's not a video game. And
you know, it's funny you said that, because I was thinking the same thing. What is the difference? Because we can't begin to understand what you went through. That fear or that fight or flight thing,
not
right?
To panic. Yeah. How do you do it?
The difference between adrenaline and training and panic.
You know, it's a combination of, you know, the experience of being in not exactly situations like that, but that had been my third deployment overseas. I'd been at my 10-year mark in the military at that point, so I had, you know, quite a bit of training. And to understand that, you know, fear is something that's natural, but if you allow it to control you, it causes you to freeze up and pause. You know, when I look back that day, I don't ever remember really being scared for myself or thinking about any of the stuff that might happen to me. I was scared and fearful for what was going on with Sergeant Gallegos up at that Humvee and Sergeant Breeding up at the mortar position and the guys around me. And to understand, it's just a time, hey, it's time to do our job. I need to do mine because the guys to my left and right are going to do theirs. And that's, you know, you focus on those things and try not to focus on the stuff that's kind of out of your control.
There is, you know, the rule of no man left behind, which American servicemen and women will always live by. You lost eight guys that day while taking out 150 Taliban in a fight that there's no way you should have been able to compete in, let alone win. But in coming home, do you feel some responsibility to check in on those guys' families occasionally?
That was part of doing the book, was having the families involved, you know, to make sure what was said about their husbands or sons was done properly, and making sure that their stories continue to get told for those that no longer can. I was just out in D.C. with Mace's mom having dinner and his brother here a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of those, you know, the guys I serve with, their families are my families. It just continues on even after service. That family and camaraderie, it just grows.
Eric, I wanted you to at least get a chance to say hi to Sergeant Romachet, because, you know, this is one of those moments where you look around the room and you go, really, what do we do for a living?
No, it's an honor to meet you, and I commend you for your service, and thanks for putting that book out. I've read parts of it, and it is a really compelling, powerful story, and thanks for sharing it.
Oh, I appreciate that.
It's got to be a movie. It's a movie, right? It's got to be a movie.
Yeah, I mean, fingers crossed. We'll see. Vanessa, one of the Gold Star moms, was actually the one that kind of put it in perspective with me, is, hey, Clint, you know, your generation doesn't read a whole lot, so if you really want the...
put a movie. Clint, who do you want to play you?
You know, I doesn't really make a difference to me.
Come on, you thought about it. Who's going to play you?
Matt Damon?
Matt Damon would be good.
No, I think he's way too tall. I was thinking someone like maybe Danny DeVito or something.
Well, that seems like the right call. The book is called Red Platoon. What are you doing with the rest of your life now? Do you know?
You know, I'm able to be in a position now where, you know, I can do some consulting for a couple of weapons manufacturers. It's actually got me out for the NRA show this week. I do sit on the board for a couple of nonprofits, military charities that are very near and dear to me that I'm able to help support and try to raise money and funds with. And then in between kind of not doing that stuff or doing it, I get to come home and sit there and watch SpongeBob or Teen Titans Go with my five-year-old son and be there for my girls as they're going to school now. So it's kind of a way to also pay back to the family that supported me for years.
Can't imagine. Someday those kids are going to be able to get to grow up, and they're going to read about you in this book and know your story. And I hope you take time to pat yourself on the back, even if it's just for a moment.
Well, appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Staff Sergeant Clinton Romachet, the book's called Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. Value is a different discussion, but value is what you are to all of us. And thank you for this, for the book, for what I believe will be an eventual movie for you deadbeat millennials like my kids that don't read. And stay safe, man. Stay safe. You're home. Enjoy your life.
Will do. Appreciate it. Thank you so much for letting me tell the story.
All the best. I admit, I'm a pushover. But you talk to those guys. Come on.
How many of those guys have there been in America?
Come on.
And can you imagine a meeting, all those guys in one room talking?
Yeah, you know what you do? You go, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong room. Yeah.
And who's the first person they all want to help? The other person.
Well, they all
the other
that,
guy, the other
sort
girl.
Of like, I'm not the hero.
Yeah, no, they are. Oh, no.
He doesn't remember being nervous.
Oh, man.
I'm nervous
now. I'm nervous this morning. When
me
I
too.
I'm nervous getting on the L.
Remember that cartoon noise where somebody'd run out of a room, they'd jump into the air, they'd hold for a second, you hear that clunkety clunkety clunk?
Yeah.
That's what the rest of us
exactly.
would do. And then, Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. Clinton Romachet, Medal of Honor recipient, who inexplicably wants Danny DeVito to play him in the movie. Eric, thank you. How do people follow you on social media?
Adel64.
And Pat, how about you?
Pat_Brady.
And thank you guys for the expertise as well. Please be careful when you leave. Bernie Sanders is outside, and he's going to yell at you.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you.
And tonight, guess what? It's it's going to be seen. Yeah, Hollywood, you know I love you more than what I should. Yeah, Hollywood, well, kiss me good.
Dean Richards on the road. Where are you today?
I am in entertainment mobile unit number one, off on a very, very important assignment.
Can you say what the assignment is, or is it top secret?
Oh yeah, no, I can share this. It's not top secret. The CW network is having what they call their upfronts today. That's where the networks gather advertisers and tell the world what their schedules are going to be.
What are they having them in Northbrook? How are you in the car going to that?
Well, it's in New York.
Oh, you're in New York. Okay.
I'm not in New York. I'm in Chicago, but they're having a presentation for local advertisers here in Chicago.
Got it.
And I'm going to that. I've got my knee pads on, and
the knee pads are on just because Dean's knees are hurt.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you could make up the true punchline at home. Joe Jackson's in the news. There's a Good Wife spinoff that Andrea is very excited about.
Woo!
Is the Ryan Crowe? Good, that'll save time. Ryan Gosling, Russell Crowe movie worth your $12? What's it cost to go to a movie now?
$12, $10, $12. Yeah.
Okay. Allison,
I told you the last time that Steve actually paid to go see a movie.
Alice in Chains and Guns N' Roses and other people. Coming up as well. But can I ask you something right off the bat? Have you seen the new Justin Timberlake Can't Stop This Feeling video?
Ask me if I can't stop dancing to it.
It's terrific. The song's terrific. The dancing's terrific. However, I am surprised how similar the video is to Pharrell.
Happy.
I'm happy.
Happy.
Yeah.
It's a little odd. It's a little odd directorial choice. But I got to tell you, I was happy when I watched the Justin Timberlake video. And I love Justin Timberlake. He's great.
It's a good success formula. I mean, it's one of the most successful songs and videos of, I guess it's been a couple of years now that it's come out. Artists normally don't like to, do a straightaway copy like this one is. But it, both songs are so joyous and so fun. And, I'm not sure that anyone's objecting to it, but that has definitely been noticed over and over again. Even the similarity in the song. I mean, the song is very happy, like,
yeah,
which is fine, guys, because I can't stop dancing. You know me.
Oh yeah.
If there's a bouncy beat, I'm cutting a rug.
Well, next Friday when we have the Walk of Fame induction ceremony, and you're going to be honored. By the way, Dean's got a busy day for this Friday. Is it this Friday you have the Silver Circle?
Tomorrow is the Chicago Television Academy, basically Hall of Fame. They call it the Silver Circle. So there's a big hoo-ha for that.
And then next Friday, Dean's doing his new thing where every Friday he gets a Lifetime Achievement Award. And next Friday,
for the month.
Next Friday he gets the Walk of Fame thing. So when everybody's here, if this happy themed sort of dancing thing works, let's just shoot a video for the show.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I love that.
I want to see Uncle Dean dance.
Yeah, again. Joe Jackson, The Good Wife, and the other things I mentioned when we come back. But first, at 8:17, by the way, Joe Jackson is not The Good Wife. Mary Vandeveld is here first,
for
though.
Mary.
Dean, are you car dancing?
I am. The lady next to me is staring at me even more oddly than she was a minute ago.
I imagine people outside the window wondering why the old guy's dancing. By the way, in this case, the old guy's me. But that's a little clip of Justin Timberlake's ripoff of Pharrell's Happy, at least by way of video. So.
Nobody was harmed in the ripping off of.
No. Speaking of harm, Joe Jackson's in the hospital. Did someone hurt him?
No, this was, I think this may have something more to do with his age. He's 87 years old. Not that that means that 87-year-olds ought to be in the hospital, just that he was. He was suffering from some respiratory ailment and high fever So they rushed him to the hospital. They say that he is now in stable condition, continuing to be watched. Son Jermaine says that he's up in the hospital room. He's telling jokes to everybody and that he's doing much better than he was. 11 children, almost all of them, you know, musical professional, Janet, the late Michael, Jermaine, Tito, Marlon, Groucho, Zeppo,
Zippy,
all the
Greg, Jackson, Peter, Bobby,
formerly of Gary, Indiana,
Tiger.
It's one heck of a family that man has.
The Good Wife. There's going to be a spinoff.
There is. They haven't said what the name is going to be, but Christine Baranski from the original cast is going to be part of it, and it's supposed to be set. Andrea, you can tell me if this, you know, if this is good or not. But they tell us that the premise is going to be that it's going to be set a year after whatever happened in the series finale from, was it last week?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
So a year after Andrea was disappointed and went to bed angry.
I did go to bed angry. That's good,
or
though.
Excited?
I'm,
did it be more? Or?
Dean, I'm thrilled. Honestly, because I think I talked to you about this. I was so unhappy with how it ended. They just left it wide open. It was just no closure, not a good ending, and I'm glad that there is going to be a spinoff. Christine Baranski, one of my favorite characters, phenomenal actress anyway, and Cush Jumbo, who they just brought on, she's a British actress. She really stole the last season of The Good Wife, I thought, so I'm glad she's going to be on board for that, too.
So maybe that's why they left the finale a little bit on the open side, because they knew that they were going to have more coming up.
That could be. I'm glad, though.
All right, before you go, and you will, The Nice Guys. The Nice Guys, Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. Can you review this yet?
I can review it tomorrow. I can tell you that I have sort of mixed feelings about the movie. Some levels it works, on some levels it doesn't. I'll tell you a lot more about it tomorrow. But I will say, I think there is, you know, something kind of good that Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling both going out of their comfort zones. I mean, we don't really know these guys primarily for comedy in any way, and they are kind of spreading their wings a little bit. I talked with both of them in L.A. recently, talked with Russell Crowe about hosting Saturday Night Live recently. But also, interestingly, I noticed when I was watching this movie that something reminded me of like an old school comedian. I couldn't put my finger on it. In Ryan Gosling's role, and he confirmed for me what I was thinking.
Yeah, I grew up on Abbott and Costello movies, and my parents were too cheap to get a proper Blockbuster membership, so we got movies from the library, and they had Bible movies and Abbott and Costello movies, and I loved those films, and, you know, when we were shooting this, it was like 4 a.m. and it was freezing and I had to find a dead body. And I basically did that to keep myself awake.
SNL, you know, now this, it's like it's like going in a new direction, it seems like.
Yeah, it's none of that's a thought process. The SNL thing came up, you know, I was just talking to Ryan about it actually. And he'd done it in December and he had a ball doing it, you know. Man, they've been asking me to do that since 1997, you know, and I've never had the time. You've got to dedicate 6 days to SNL. You know, you don't just pop in and out. You've got to be there all week as it develops and stuff. A particular group of cast that they have there at the moment are excellent, man, you know, and they have a great energy amongst the ensemble, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, all of it was fun.
That's Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe talking to action star Dean Richards. Do you find them both to be delightful?
They are both rather delightful. Ryan Gosling and kind of a low-key, sort of understated, semi-sarcastic, but not snarly sort of way. And Russell Crowe, who, when I first started interviewing him, this, it's got to be over 10 years ago, I would think, was super defensive, super, you know, guarded, and anything that he said couldn't be more relaxed and more freewheeling now. I had a terrific conversation. I'm going to play back those full conversations this coming weekend on my Sunday show. And you'll hear Russell Crowe was just in a great mood that day. And so was Ryan Gosling. These guys have been sniping at each other back and forth, good-naturedly sniping at each other. In appearances, Russell Crowe has been referring to Ryan Gosling as
his leading lady in this movie. It's pretty funny.
Well, that's funny. And Russell Crowe is, not that I've ever had an issue with this, but Russell Crowe's packing on the pounds.
He claims that he put on the weight for this movie.
Mm, don't think so.
That's the same excuse that I use, by the way. I put on the weight just to go see that movie. But
I've been using that excuse since I was 25.
It's sympathy weight.
That could be. That's entirely possible. Because when you're standing next to Ryan Gosling, don't you want to try to look as, you know, overweight and out of
Absolutely.
Shape as possible?
Yeah, yeah. If you're standing next to Ryan Gosling, you just go, yeah, I know you're looking at him. I'll be over here if you need me. Anybody want a water?
Or banana split.
All right, well, you have fun with your CW friends.
Yes, I'm going to review that tomorrow. I'm going to review Neighbors 2 tomorrow and Angry Birds tomorrow. So we've got a few movies that are taking on the Captain America monolith this weekend.
All right, buddy. All the best. That's Dean Richards, big-time award winner.
Ryan Dempster.
There's a 1-1 to Freeman.
Oh, he caught it. Right into the palm of Dempster's glove.
Ooh.
That is a little smile there from Dempster.
What would Harry say right now about this win?
Well, I got to tell you, there's a lot of champagne in here. I haven't seen this much champagne since my wedding. We had a party just like this. It was phenomenal. Go, Cubs!
That was outstanding.
Woody does the afternoon show with Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis. We are very happy to have Ryan Dempster join us to talk baseball, as he does again now. Good morning, Mr. Dempster.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen.
How are you?
General public.
What are you doing this morning? What does Ryan Dempster's Thursday look like?
This morning entailed some get up, make some coffee, and then get some breakfast ready for some Rugrats, drop them off at school, and I'm going to run some errands. I got some stuff I need to take care of. You know, we're running low on water and not just like in the world, but, you know, in the household. So.
Right. You got to get to what you got to get. I like the idea of you. I like the idea of you driving by a little league field and just dropping in and, you know, coaching the kids up.
I did that last night. Actually helped coach my son's little league. It's pretty funny because you know, sometimes some of the kids, they recognize on the other teams, and then their coach is trying to get them to figure out how to practice, and they're too busy trying to come over and want an autograph or something like that. So it's really cute. I love that stuff, man. Seeing these kids now and watching through my son's eyes is taking me back all the way to when I was a kid.
You know, what's funny is because I know Woody works with one of his kids' baseball teams as well. How are you the head coach? Dave, you and I both coached our kids.
Yes, we did.
How are you the head coach if Ryan Dempster shows up and wants to be the assistant coach?
A lot of times I like to stand out of the way. You know, I have a tough time sometimes with little league coaches. I just sit there and marvel at the fact is like, who's trying to win this game, the kids or you? Who's it more important to? And sometimes I feel like it's more important to the coaches. So I try to keep my nose out of it and just help out where I can.
We'll get to the Cubs in just a second, but you've said it. Every team's going to go through these skids. The White Sox on a mini skid now. They've dropped four. However, they did get their second triple play of the year. That's pretty odd.
Yeah.
Any reason for Sox fans to be concerned, or is this what you expected?
No, I think it just happens. I think, you know, you're going to have those stretches where you battle. And, you know, even when you have as good of pitching as they've had, you know, you're going to find maybe you run into, just like the Cubs had in Milwaukee, a good starting pitching on the other side for a couple of days and they neutralize the lineup a little bit. But they'll be right back there. You know, they're feeling it down there, and you just find a way to get out of that little streak and go out there and start winning some ball games again. And to me, in my opinion, when I look at their ball club, the way they're set up, they're going to be right there all the way through this whole season, right to the end.
And did you ever have an itch to manage? I picture you as a great manager, but maybe you're too much of a smartass.
I feel like a little bit of that. I can focus. I tend to, as the game goes on, I find something. Maybe it's go light a hot foot under somebody, or you know, doing those kind of things in the dugout, that I always felt like I could make a good bench coach more than a manager. You know, managers have a lot of work. They got to deal with all kinds of stuff, managing a lot of guys and doing those things and in-game and media and making sure everything's going smooth. And maybe a little bit too much for me. But, you know, that's a long way down the road if something like that was to happen.
We think of catchers as being the best position players that turn out to be managers because they have to manage so much of the game while they're playing. I'm trying to think of a great pitcher who turned out to be a great manager. Am I missing somebody?
You know, I feel like Bud Black was a really good manager in San Diego. You know, pitcher for a while, and a lot of guys respected him. I think pitchers do get a bad rap on that. I think because they think that, you know, we pitched once every fifth day, so the other 4 days we weren't paying attention. But I really felt like I always tried to, you know, learn as much about all parts of the game, not just pitching. You know, where to be on defense, where to be in the outfield. How to get guys over, game plans, how to expose a bullpen if you can, and different things like that. So, I just don't ever have the itch. I don't know. I enjoy what I'm doing right now.
We'll come back and talk about the Cubs in a second. Who's the one pitcher you played with who was the goofiest, maybe the most superstitious, or had the absolute pregame routine you couldn't interrupt or he'd punch you? Who was the one goofball you remember?
Oh, wow. Well, goofball-wise, probably Rich Hill. He was pretty goofy.
And what was the thing?
I don't know. He had all kinds of stuff working. You know, just his body in general was goofy. He had all these little routines. He was pretty. He was pretty fun. Superstitious wise, maybe Alex Fernandez, ex White Sox, and then Florida Marlin when I was a rookie. Like this guy, he walked into the field and like it was funny. It was like he was a different person on his fifth day. You know, you couldn't talk to him. He'd go into a dark room and get himself all ready for the game and have all these routines as far as what trainer touched him where and what pair of underwear he put on and all that kind of stuff. So he was probably the one who, for a little while, I felt like, oh, I need to do some of these things. Otherwise, I'm not going to get anybody out. But it turns out just throwing the baseball in the right spot is what actually works.
Isn't that funny? Hmm. Balls and strikes don't matter. Who was the Cubs closer who was famous for taking the naps?
Oh, Lee Smith.
Yeah. Lee Smith. Lee Smith, he tells great stories about taking naps, and then like, but one kid on the team who was designated to come wake him up, but not until he was really needed.
Yeah, he'd go sit out in the car, take a nap usually until about the fifth inning, and come inside and have a sandwich and watch the Andy Griffith Show. And then when they'd say, "Hey, Lee, it looks like you're going to be pitching today," he said, "All right, well, I'll go throw my stuff on and I'll be ready."
That guy's got to have a pulse of about 15.
Here it is. On the ground is Zobrist. Cubs win 2-1 the final in 13.
Baseball season's underway. Ryan Dempster standing by, Cubs legend. And one of my favorite Canadians. You know, I got a lot of favorite Canadians, but you're right up there.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, we started talking about players who had odd routines. Dave, you brought up Turk Wendell.
Turk Wendell, yeah. Went, brushed his teeth and wouldn't step on. A lot of guys are superstitious about.
Did he rinse and spit when he was in the batter's box?
I don't remember him doing that.
Didn't he eat licorice when he was in the dugout, too?
He had to have red licorice, too. He had all kinds of crazy, crazy routines. That slam the rosin bag down.
Nomar Garcia Parra, too, right?
Oh, my gosh, man. Nomar, you said pitchers. By far, hands down, the most superstitious player. I love Nomar, but never, if there was ever a fire in a building, I did not want to be stuck behind him in the staircase because he had to do 2 feet on every step every time you walk up in any dugout, anything. I'm like, dude, it's okay, man. Just step up. Keep going.
Well, he had absolute OCD. Was he ever diagnosed?
He's self-proclaimed. Like, I asked him sometimes, like, when you go home at night, do you lock it, unlock it, lock it, unlock it, lock it, unlock
it? Right.
And he said, absolutely, yeah. Like, I mean, it was everything. He had this routine where he sat on his glove before the game in the dugout, and he always had to touch third base when he ran out. I mean, he had the batting glove thing. He had multiple moving parts. There's a lot of moving parts to that that engine he had running there.
But there is something to be said for, and I'm not defending completely kooky, But there is something to be said for finding whatever you need in whatever sport you're involved in to lock into a pre-routine, whether it's before you hit a golf shot, before you're ready to pitch a baseball or hit a baseball, before a play in the National Football League, before you hit the ice in hockey, whatever the case may be, right?
No, absolutely. Hey, man, if you find something that works for you, you know, then do it. You know, it's about getting in the right mental state. So if you have this routine that kind of takes you there, go for it. And, you know, and just the same thing, like if you're struggling, you know, this is what I don't understand. Kevin Millar was a good friend of mine and teammate for a long time. And he was the best at this. If he was going through a struggle, I'd watch him shave facial hair mid-game. I mean, he'd go up and be like, I'm going to take this beard into a goatee. I'm going to take this goatee into a Fu Manchu. Anything to change it up. And I'll never forget George Fabregas, who was he caught for the White Sox for a little bit of Angels catchers in Florida. And he was just mired in this slump of, like, it was crazy. It was like 0 for 25 or something like that, 0 for 30. And Kevin just said to him, hey, why don't you change bats? Like, here, why don't we use this bat? Like, you're using the same bat every time. And George honestly said, no, I feel really good with this bat. And we just laughed. We're like, George, you haven't had a hit in a month. Use a fungo or something.
Right, right.
Around. Use the other end of the bat. It's not working what you're doing. So.
Two words, whiff full.
Hey, Ryan, completely, obviously, very much on the outside of what goes on in the clubhouse and the game, but I love the crazy suits and the footy pajamas and things that Joe Maddon does, brings in the crazy animals, but I know some see that as like, what the heck is he doing? Is that guy bonding? I mean, does it really bring you guys together?
No, it does, man. Like, those guys, they, you know, it seems really out there sometimes, and I know that there's some people who, you know, they don't see it as an important part of anything. They just see it as goofy, but it is team building. It's fun to see these guys embrace it, you know, when wear their goofy suits and they don't even hesitate. They all come out. I mean, these guys are coming out swinging with some hot pink and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, the American Legion week last year, you know, when he locked the locker room and said, you can't come in until this time. And these are the kind of things that I think they work because they're uniform. They include everyone. There's nobody that's like, oh, a veteran guy. Doesn't matter if you're a rookie. Before it used to always be, hey, all the rookies dress up. Well, now it's everyone dresses up. And I think it just kind of does bring everybody together. It brings for a lot of laughs, especially on those plane rides. Like, if people could see, you know, those plane rides, how much fun they are. And you have those kind of moments where you're walking through security or, you know, you're pulling into the hotel at, you know, middle of the night and all the hotel staff sees guys rolling in that. And it just, it provides for a lot of kind of laughs to break up the monotony of what's a very long season.
Sense of family. Create that sense of
100%.
Yeah, create that sense of family. I do it here on the show, Demps. After the show, we usually get together and I have everyone on the staff tell me something brilliant I said in the previous 4 hours.
Yeah.
That's team building.
Yeah, Steve building. It's not team building, it's Steve building.
All right, so it worked last night because I don't think I've ever seen a 2-1 game quite like that. And there were so many turns and so many times the Cubs could have lost that game in extra innings. What does a game like that do, Ryan, in terms of not only picking up the team as a whole, but a bullpen, which maybe the last few games had here and there a shaky moment or two?
Yeah, well, it's just great. I mean, the job that Travis Wood did last night, where he came in that situation, and then bases loaded, and then what happened? I just think that's amazing. A reliever comes in with the bases loaded, none out, gets out of it, and then proceeds to hit in the next inning with the bases loaded, and they didn't even want to pitch to him because he's that good of a hitter. So, and he walks in the winning run. So. You know, just a huge pickup. Like you said, so many things. We had a reliever pinch hit. He didn't even pitch.
How about that?
Hill and, you know, just so many random things, and they end up working out. You know, when we take our time and we execute our game plan, you know, good things like that happen. So, you know, it was a great win for us, especially, you know, a couple days of being neutralized by some really good pitching. So, you know, hopefully today we go out there and win the series like we're capable of doing. But games like that, when you play those games, they transcend into the next day, and the next day versus losing those games can kind of take you the other way sometimes.
And with full respect for everyone, and that's 99.9% of the audience that actually works for a living, how tough is it to play a late game, turn around, and have a noon start the next day or whatever today is?
Yeah, you know what? It is. It's quick, man. Especially it's a getaway day too. So you got to remember those guys are getting back to their hotel room. They're packing up their clothes. They're leaving early because they got to get to the ballpark, and then they're flying out afterwards, going to San Francisco. So you're going to see a lot of guys on that plane ride if you were to walk up and down the aisles with, you know, a neck pillow on and their eyes closed and crashing on that plane ride after this 24-hour period flying out west.
This is an era of specialization, and Dempsey even missed out on this. The Cubs actually have a lullaby consultant now, too.
They do.
Yeah, actually sings the players to sleep. And they're very young, so, you know, and it's important to have a lullaby consultant. So, Demps, great talking to you, man. Enjoy your errand running.
Yeah, I will. You guys, too, have a great weekend.
All right, see
you, buddy.
Too. He's good, isn't he?
Yes,
he love is. Him.
Running Demps there. We continue to meet some of the coolest people in America on this show. Stand by, about 10 minutes away. And he's going to be modest, I know. But trust me, he's one of the coolest people in America.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
9:12 in the morning, we continue the Steve Cochran Show, number 653 at Cochran Show on Twitter, facebook.com/Steve Cochran Show. 312-981-7200 is the number. Don't expect any fast answers or conclusions to the Egyptian air flight disappearing overnight. And at some point, there will be some coward that will take credit for taking this plane down. And those folks will be dealt with in due time. But we won't have any fast answers. We know what we know now, and you'll hear it with Ryan and throughout the day here on WGN News. I asked my friend Pat Brady to rejoin us. Pat's a pilot, been a pilot for a long time, and through the course of being a pilot, that's a family in and of itself. And you meet a lot of interesting people, right?
Oh, great people, fun people, especially the veterans and the guys that fly the warbirds around.
And you and I share a tremendous amount of respect for those who have served, and we try to give back wherever we can. But for those of you who think you know the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, it's much more than just a movie. So explain to me, you probably know the answer, how you came to know our guest.
Our guest founded an organization called Tuskegee Next, and the Tuskegee Airmen, as most people know, an elite group of African Americans back when it was a segregated military that became crackerjack pilots in World War II. A lot of them still live here in the Chicago area. And our guest here, Steve Davis, who's the chairman of the DuPage Airport Authority, came up with a concept that, hey, that legacy we need to continue, and we need to continue by educating kids in the opportunities in the aviation industry. So he came up with this concept of Tuskegee Next, where we raise some money and put some kids through a flight training program, get them their pilot's licenses over the summer, and teach him some life skills. But he could describe it in much better detail than I. But that's
yeah, and also you did a nice job of describing the Tuskegee Airmen. But this is another example. And Steve, welcome. Nice to meet you. Obviously,
good morning.
I really hope this is another opportunity that parents and grandparents who are listening this morning, you take to tell your kids this story. You know, because you don't want your kids just to go, oh, is that movie you like to watch sometimes, Grandpa or Dad or Mom or whatever? This was an incredibly important part of American military history. Because it's hard to believe, because we don't think of World War II as being that long ago. Sure. That without, and I believe it was called the Tuskegee Experiment first.
It was. It
right? Because they thought it would fail.
Yes.
That was the closed-mindedness of all of it.
They were going to prove that black men could not fly airplanes.
Right. Yeah. And black men were inferior, so therefore, how could we possibly allow them to? But there's an interesting twist to this, and that's Jimmy Doolittle, right? Jimmy Doolittle comes in and says, go get them.
Yes. Yes. And I've met as Pat was mentioning, we have about six or seven still living today Tuskegee Airmen, and they have a chapter that they call the Dodo Chapter, the Chicago Dodo Chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen. And the interesting thing about these men, these heroes, and these true patriots, when they came back from serving in World War II, they could not find jobs in aviation. So they formed this chapter called the Dodo Chapter because the dodo bird does not fly. And
right.
Most of them never had the opportunity to fly again. My good friend Milton Williams, who I think will be 92 this year.
It's about right age-wise, yeah.
He just speaks so eloquently of there were two experiments going on at Tuskegee at that time. One, as we know, the Tuskegee Airmen, and the other was a horrific experiment with the effects of STDs, what we'd call STDs today, syphilis. And this, it's just tremendous, the fortitude, the hero nature of these men that went through this program, And today, I just call them true patriots, and they're an inspiration. As Pat was talking one morning, or about 2 or 3 years ago, you know, as the chairman of DuPage Airport, the finest GA airport in the country, you know, we just have such a great facility. And living here in the Chicago area, because we're all Chicagoans, the region, the Chicago region affects us all. And when we read and when we hear about things going on, one 4th of July weekend about 2 or 3 years ago, we had 72 shootings. And, you know, you wake up in the morning and you say, I want to do something. I want to do something that makes a difference. And you think about the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen. You think about this great facility that we have at DuPage Airport.
How do you put them together?
How do you put them together? And we have these kids, these absolute brilliant kids that just need a chance. You know, I was not raised with a silver spoon in my mouth. Someone gave me a chance. So how can we come up with a program that honors the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen, that takes this great facility we have here in DuPage County and puts it together to bring these kids, these at-risk kids, these brilliant at-risk kids, and give them an opportunity? And by the way, we understand that the FAA is going to have a mandatory retirement, reduced level, so there are going to be job opportunities. So
that's exactly right. So why not give them a chance to maximize their lives with something they may not even know they're interested in yet, or expose them to something they're interested in they might not otherwise have an opportunity to do? Now, you touched on something I think is really important there, too. You had a family that loved you and raised you, even though you didn't have a whole lot of money growing up.
Absolutely.
So you bust your tail. You go to Tennessee. You're on a football scholarship. You played football at Tennessee. You come out. You start your own business many years ago. It's very successful. You got a bunch of successful kids.
Oh, bless you.
That you were bragging about off the air, and I salute that because I brag about mine. So why not pay it forward, and why not pay it forward with something you know so well and you're passionate about?
I couldn't understand why anybody would not want to. You don't get out of this life with very much, but what you're able to leave behind. And paying it forward is what's valuable to me. When somebody looks at you and said, you've been a blessing in my life, that God would allow me to sow into somebody's life, I consider it a privilege. And
sure.
When you sit and when you're out there at the DuPage Airport, I got to tell you, it's a beautiful facility. Did I mention we're having a 5K run on Saturday morning?
This is the one where you're chasing Pat because he owes you money?
Yes.
No, it's on the runway.
We're going to run the runway.
We're going to do it on the runway.
You told me about this. This is a cool idea.
Yeah.
This is a cool idea. So you actually get to run the runway. Now, the planes will be landing in front of you or behind you?
You're going to be running between the planes. No.
Right.
I don't know. It'll be fun.
Yeah, we'll be fun. So we're going to shut we have
you're shutting down the runway.
We're going to shut down one of our runways. We actually have one of our runways.
They're just not going to tell us which when we start.
It should be Dodge plane. No. One of our runways is actually longer than Midway. So
is that right?
Absolutely.
So it's like a mile long, right?
Yes, it's over a mile long. And then the parallel runway to that, we'll probably shut that down and then have a 5K event. So you'll be right there on the runway. It'll be a great experience. But most importantly, it'll be raising awareness, friend-raising, fundraising.
Sure.
For what we're doing with Tuskegee Next. And hopefully we'll have some of the kids. The timing is not perfect because I wanted to have two or three of the kids on with me today.
Yeah.
But they're in school.
We're not interrupting that.
Okay. We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We had 10 kids our first year, 8 after the medicals, and 3 young ladies and 5 men, and all soloed, and 6 now have their pilot's license.
How about that?
In the time frame to do that, I mean, when I got mine, it took me a long, long time, kind of like third grade. These guys did it in men and women did it in 8 weeks, which is amazing. And to watch them fly and watch their faces.
Thirst for knowledge with concentrated training. That's what you have. You get to be a little bit older. Not that you are, Pat. But it's hard for you. It's hard for you to keep the facts in your head. Jump in, Hunter.
Steve, want to ask you, don't you find or do you find that when you give these kids, and I say kids lightly, students, the opportunity or a little bit of attention, they just grasp it and they just run with it?
Well, it's a great, you know, I'm a smiley guy. I when all else fails, smile. You know, you look at people and you smile.
Right.
And when I met these kids, and the first couple of weeks, I'd walk in, I'd shake their hands and look at them, and they wouldn't look at me. Then I said, please, you know, all I ask, because we're investing in you, is that you work hard, you study hard, and when I look at you, look me in the eye and smile.
That's it.
And something happened after they soloed. There was confidence that came in these kids that these kids are going to be, and they may not all be pilots, but I can tell you that they are figuratively and literally launched into a future because it is very difficult to fly an airplane.
Think about it. These are at-risk kids who now are flying an airplane on their own and landing it.
Yes.
The landing part, by the way, I find very important. Stick around just a second because we want to know more about Tuskegee next, and we'll tell you guys how you can help as well.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
WGN Radio is the sound of Chicago.
720 WGN.
925. Pat Brady introduced us to Steve Davis. Happy to have him here. Tuskegee next is what we're talking about. Steve's got plenty to do with this time. But this is how he's paying it forward. By the way, the company is called the Will Company?
The Will Group.
The Will Group, sorry. Yeah. Big lighting interest company and very successful. Named after your dad.
Yes.
Yeah, that's nice to hear, too.
Thank you.
How many kids are your own?
I have eight.
Just eight?
Just eight.
Yeah. Yes. Got a hobby?
kids. coaching the kids.
And the kids are all excited and doing their own thing?
They're all doing. We have an attorney. We have a security guard. We have a med school student. We have a couple entrepreneurs. We have a stay-at-home mom. They're all just doing great, working in the business. Really blessed, really fortunate.
How many grandkids?
We have three.
Three.
Yes.
I got my first one.
Yeah.
So. 5 months old. It's pretty special. Pretty amazing. We're all blessed, which is one of the reasons we're here to talk about Tuskegee next, taking kids from tough situations and tough neighborhoods and showing them an interest they may not even know they have yet, or maybe they dream that they'd always want to do, but never thought they could have, and that's teach them how to fly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if people want to know how they can help, what do they do?
Well, we always want to be friend-raiser. Just sharing our story, I think, is first and foremost because, again, these are true patriots, and people need to know. Our kids need to know the history of the Tuskegee Airmen. Secondly, is give. Give. Come out and support our kids. Anybody who's in aviation, and Pat probably knows this better than me, it's about $10,000 to $15,000 to get your private pilot's license.
Is that what it is currently, Pat? Is it running that number?
Yeah, at least. At least.
Yeah. And we bring them on campus for this year. We're going to do it in 12 weeks. We sent them home on Friday and brought them back on Sunday. This year, we're going to keep them during the full time because the study time's needed. And quite frankly, they want to be there.
Sure.
The camaraderie, we do some life skill training. We do some coaching, exercise. It's a tough 10, 12
And these weeks. Aren't kids that necessarily even know each other, so they're making friends too, right?
They're making friends. Now, there are a couple. there is a Aviation Academy Tamara Holmes here in Chicago has with After School Matters. It does a tremendous job getting these kids at, you know, middle school age. Then we have Legacy Flight Academy, a guy by the name of Ken out of Tuskegee at the actual field that has a program where they immerse kids in aviation experience. And then we want to bring them to our experience at Tuskegee next, where we can, again, literally launch them into flight training.
TuskegeeNext.org is the website. It's a good-looking website.
Oh, thank you.
And you can donate right there.
Thank you. Yes, you can. And the Tuskegee Next is the next generation of aviators.
And the idea is if we raise enough money for these kids, you can scholarship them into the program because, you know, you're asking people to train these kids how to fly. That's a committed amount of time from professionals who have their own jobs to do as well. And even if they're helping out the organization, you can't do it for free.
No. It does take resources, and we're not bashful asking because we think it's good dollar spent.
And Steve brought me on board because I'm a jerk and I will ask. I do believe, too.
I'm with you. If it's money for the right reason, I'll ask for it.
It's C3, right? It's deductible.
And we've had tremendous support from Chairman Cronin at DuPage County. Chairman Preckwinkle, Mayor Emanuel is supporting, and we had the governor come in and speak at one of our fundraisers. So we just want to get the word out. And
around the country, by the way, what I'd love you to do is go to TuskegeeNext.org because there's cool stuff there and links, and just put it up on your social media today. Oh. You know, spread the word virally that way as fast as you possibly can. For those of you who go, stop talking to me about your computer, Steve. Computers are a fad and they're never going to catch on. You can send a check to Tuskegee Next, Box 1061 in Wheaton, 60187, and we'll put that up on social media as well so people can write a check if they will. You and I have to stay in touch because
please.
I love what you're doing.
Please, I'm going to grab a hold of you. I'm going to attack you like I would a Vegas Ferguson if you were running by me with a football.
Based on our mutual football experiences, I was a lineman. And you were fast, and I don't see that happening for you.
See, my money is on Steve Davis.
Yeah, the other Steve.
Yeah, mine too.
My money's on Steve Davis.
The other handsome black man in the studio, right. I understand. Yeah, I understand. But God bless you, man. It really is a good story, and it's such a nice thing to do. And I know your dad and your family would be awfully proud of you doing it. You're a good man.
Oh, thank you.
So, and these kids, I look forward to meeting some of these kids. When is a 5K, Pat?
It's tomorrow out at DuPage Airport,
Saturday,
8 a.m.
Saturday.
Saturday. Sorry. Yeah. I'm running, buddy. You want to run?
Let me tell you something. If it's tomorrow, they are going to have problems with planes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be out there tomorrow. Nobody else
Saturday
will be
morning.
There.
I probably with these knees, I won't be running, but I'm willing to hire someone to run for me on behalf of the program.
I will do that.
There you go. Are you going to run? Are you going to run?
I'm going to pitter-patter my way for 3 points.
So are we going up and down 3.1
miles?
David Byrd's going to lay it out for us, and we've got the staff already. We had a board of directors meeting, and they said that we will be prepared.
Pat, my money is on Steve Davis.
Oh, yeah. No.
And by the way, since it's at an airport, instead of cups of water halfway through, there'll be a Sbarro. And you can stop and get some pizza and then come back.
For $40.
And we're going to try to have a longest drive contest, but the FAA.
That was my idea. I want to do a long drive contest on the runway. On the runway.
How great is that?
See if you could hit it a mile.
You probably could.
That's a fantastic idea. Yeah. Don't take that off the table yet.
You got to keep it right in the middle, because they slope off. You got to go right down the middle.
Yeah, you got to hit the concrete.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. It's great to meet you. And again, TuskegeeNext.org. Please take a look. At the bare minimum, consider helping, or just go ahead and donate and save yourself some time.
And from the bottom of my heart and in the Tuskegee Next Board, our members, our students, thank you to WGN. We appreciate you.
Thank you. And please shake the hands of those fine heroes that we don't get to meet and tell them how much we appreciate it.
Woo! Woo! Ow!
Love that money!
Elise Glink standing by at 9:44, and we always love talking to Elise, which is great, at GlinkThinkGlink.com. But in regards to the campaign, and by the way, do I get any credit at all for not bashing Trump this morning? Not a single time.
I guess that's right.
I haven't bashed Trump once today.
That's crazy.
You'll make up for it tomorrow.
You've got 15 minutes left on the show.
That's true. I do need to get
to
work. But I want to talk to Elise about the fact that Hillary Clinton the other day said, I'm going to put Bill in charge of the economy because, you know, he's pretty good at that. Look what he did in the 90s, as if it was yesterday. So I said, let's put Elise Glink on this truth detector. Was Bill Clinton's 90s economy a matter of work by him or a matter of coincidence because he got the gig? Elise, what's the answer to that question?
The answer is that presidents have a very limited ability to directly impact the economy. But that said, this is all about aspirational living. We talked about this, I think, last week, where I think part of the attraction about Donald Trump is, you know, he's I want to be a reality TV show live, and we're kind of watching that in slow-mo. With Clinton, nobody really wants to be her, but they respect her work and her work ethic and what she's done and all the rest. And they like her. People have met her personally, really like her. So, but she doesn't have that aspirational thing. Now, Bill Clinton had that. And when people talk about how great the economy was when he was in office, it was pretty great. We had 4% average annual growth. We had median income rising. We had a budget deficit that turned to a surplus. NAFTA. Now, Mr. Trump, your favorite, did not like NAFTA. But even Ms. Donald Trump said that Bill Clinton pretty much was a good, if not great, president. And he said that as recently as 2008.
Yeah, so, but you can't hold him to anything that happened yesterday, let alone 2008.
That's true.
But so we're talking about, to use a sports analogy here, this is the quarterback thing. Too much credit, too much blame when it comes to most things, and the economy would be one of those.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of this has to do with whether or not you have the same party in the Senate and the House, because you can, as we've seen with you know, President Obama. You can have all the great ideas in the world, but if you don't have anybody who's going to either propose or enact legislation, they're just going to sit there for the most part until everybody goes on recess. I think, you know, when you think about Bill Clinton, though, his famous line was, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
Right? And I think what he was able to do very effectively was put the focus back on how people weren't getting their fair share. So taxes went up during his administration, and the economy went up, and the stock market, I don't know if you remember the 90s, but everybody was making like 20% a year in the stock market, kind of gangbusters, almost the way it's been over the last, oh, say, 5-6 years. And so people remember him very fondly. I have to say, though, I thought it was a misstep for Hillary to say she was going to put him in charge, because being the head of the economy and the head of the military, and that, what is she going to outsource her whole job? Like, this is the whole reason that you elect somebody to give you that vision. And while he could help, I think we're all still a little murky on what the role of first spouse would be.
Yeah, and it's not like he's got a completely clean record. And there's going to be people that can target her immediately, though I think she would be wise if she wins to consult him on many things. Having said,
as you said, though, Steve, this was like 20 years ago,
yeah.
Right? By the time she gets out of office, if she wins, it'll be 2020, or actually 2021 would be the next time that she would leave office.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So that's 20 years after his greatest years in office. And I got to say, when you look back where we were 20 years ago, let's see, there was no Google. There was really no Internet. AOL hadn't been born, Amazon, Apple, nothing that makes up our economy today had even been thought of.
And yeah, you could argue it's a completely different economy based on digital. Sure. Now, let's talk about this aspect of it before we run out of time. You run a business, and it's a huge business. I'm not talking about anybody in particular here.
Okay.
And you run a business where you only got $1 million loan from your father, but you've turned it into this big, beautiful company. And one of the greatest things about me is that I'm rich. Again, I'm not talking about anybody in particular. Could be anybody. But we've seen this before. I mean, we've seen it from the pitch to some extent of Mitt Romney. We've certainly seen it here in a gubernatorial campaign. Running a business, you have to answer to a board of directors at some point. Running a country, you have to answer to Congress and the American people. How similar are they?
I think running a country is completely dissimilar from running a private company, which one of the presidential candidates is running, or even a publicly traded company where you do have boards of directors and advisors and people who are investors in your company and, worse than that, big hedge funds. So I think it's very, very different. The way that you finance, and we talked about this last week or the week before, the way that you take on debt in a country and you use that money to do different things than you would if you're in a private company. I mean, the point of a private company is to enrich the people who own it. And the point of government, in my view, is to make life better for the people who live in that country. And so when you have debt and you take on debt, you use it for very, very different things. We're not trying to make everybody rich in this country. What we're trying to do, I think, is educate them, give gifts to the future, build a better society, peace in our borders, and all of these things that I think make life worth living and are so much better. And you take on debt because in times that are difficult economically, you need some way to keep everybody going. And that's the best use of debt. And the idea that you're going to negotiate that down or somehow that's not profitable debt, it just doesn't work for me.
No, because as you said, and I think you said it exactly right, debt is an investment in America. And that investment in America is not necessarily to make somebody rich.
No, I mean, today's talk is about how the Fed may actually go ahead and raise interest rates. And as you see, the stock market is reacting to that. It's down. And the companies that are doing better are the big banks, right? Because they're going to make more money on their investments if interest rates go up. So everybody's bidding up their stock. But when you think about, what that actually means and what interest rates do to people, both on the positive and the negative side, right? It's nice to borrow at a lower rate. But on the other hand, if you're you're a senior and you've got money in the bank, you're not earning anything on it, so it's hard to live. Every single thing a government does affects everything else. And we have to have the pieces of our government set up and running kind of independently rather than, somebody at the top saying, okay, Fed, now go, because there are all sorts of unintended consequences. And so that, to me, is more of a dictatorship than a presidency.
This is why Elise is great, because she takes all of this nuanced, kooky, complicated, layered financial stuff, and she says, Steve, I know you're an idiot, but I'm going to explain this to you.
And she doesn't even say the idiot part. She just thinks
it. No, that was on her head.
She just thinks it.
Yeah, that's all on her head.
Anything but.
At Glink, thinkglink.com. Thank you as always, Elise.
Hey, it's been great. See you soon.
Have a good day. All right, here's a story we didn't have time to get to earlier in the week. Robert Shapiro is talking. Remember the name Robert Shapiro?
Yeah.
Robert Shapiro was originally the lead O.J. Simpson attorney. He eventually took a back seat to Johnny Cochran. But he's out talking, did a big interview on Fox this week about O.J., about the verdict, and about his position in it, and how he feels now. How about the glove?
I tried the glove on. It was a little bit wide in my palm and a little bit long in my fingers. O.J. Simpson has enormous hands, and I knew that that glove would not fit him. I want you to walk as close to the jury as you can. Hold up your hand like you're holding the Olympic torch and pull and tug on that glove because it will not fit. And clearly it didn't.
I don't know how you feel great about that. I really don't. But to this day, Shapiro said maybe he still loses a little sleep.
There's moral justice and there's legal justice. And when that not guilty verdict was rendered, I felt legal justice was done. As far as moral justice, I haven't discussed it with anyone, including my wife.
How about that? Legal justice, but not moral justice.
On some level, if you're going to represent O.J. Simpson, I suppose you would have to have two different characters. But that doesn't make me feel any better about Robert Shapiro. I mean, come on.